The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this evening I'm going to talk about the fifth hindrance. The five hindrances are these forces in the mind, activities, ways of thinking or acting or being in the mind, which interfere with meditation practice, interfere with being mindful, hinder our capacity to be concentrated and present, focused. It's said that they tend to blind us from our own best interest. We don't understand very well what's going on when these are operating. And the five hindrances are sensual pleasure, the drive for pleasure. Nothing wrong with pleasure, but the compulsion for sensual pleasure can be a tremendous obstacle in people's lives. Ill will. And the third one is two factors, sloth and torpor, sometimes also called lethargy or dullness. And then the fourth one is also two factors, restlessness and worry. And then today, the topic is doubt. So the fifth one is doubt. So imagine that you come home to your house on a very cold, freezing day, and your house is really cold. You're in your house, it's really cold. So you're interested in having some warmth. So you have a variety of options. You can go out and try to find a really big blanket to cover your house with. Or you could go out and light a match to the forest next to your house and create a big forest fire, and that would probably warm up your house for a little while. Or you could leave your house and go to your neighbors and live with them where they have it nice and toasty. You could pick up your house and move it to the tropics. And you could just destroy your house because, you know, it's too cold to live in, so out of some kind of act of hostility because it's not cooperating, you could just destroy it. So there's, you know, something like that are options, perhaps. I think most of us would recognize a better option would be to go into the house and turn on the heater. And the house would warm up from the inside. So something like that happens in people's lives, where often we're looking externally to ourselves for where to get our warmth, where to get our sense of joy or well-being or peace, our love, our compassion. And so we go to our neighbors to get the warmth from them. We go out and set fires to the world so that somehow it'll warm us up. We abandon, destroy the very thing which can bring us some kind of benefit. We do all kinds of things, often external, taking care of things. And a little bit that's the game of the hindrances. The hindrances are often appear when we focus outside of ourselves for some deep inner happiness, kind of misdirected attempt to find peace or find what's best for us. And what we have here in practice of mindfulness, being present, is to learn how to develop the warmth within us, and so that radiates from us, rather than feeling that we're cold, and so we have to find someone else's warmth to do it for us. We have to go outside and get it for us, fill it outside. And so as we stay present in mindfulness, we learn about all the different ways in which we look outside of ourselves for our happiness. We learn all the ways in which we're kind of objectifying ourselves, objectifying the world. And slowly we learn not to objectify, but to sit here very intently, very closely, close in, come home, to be at home in our body, in our hearts, in our minds, and be here, quite here. And we learn a lot about ourselves in that process. We learn about the forces that take us away. We learn about our greed. We learn about our ill will. We learn about our confusion. And also, but more importantly, we learn to let go of that, and we learn that there's a natural, almost like a natural wellspring of joy, of peace, that's available to us when all the agitation, all the searching drops away and falls away. And so the task in meditation practice, one of the tasks is to understand the nature of all the ways in which we go externally, outside of ourselves, so that we don't do it anymore, and we can kind of really settle here very deeply in ourselves. So sometimes we go externally by we want something. Desire is a big one. So we're kind of looking for something we want. We want this and that and this and that. Or we blaming something, or angry at something, and so we're in attack mode, aversive mode. So these are all ways of kind of, you know, being dispersed. One of the ways we do this is through doubt. And doubt is said to be the most dangerous of the five hindrances, especially for the sake of meditation practice or spiritual practice, because doubt can cause a person to abandon their spiritual practice, to abandon their meditation practice, if you have enough doubt about it. It's said to be a very, very powerful force for some people. And probably for all people, sooner or later. Some people have a lot of doubt to begin with, or have a lot of doubt what they're doing, and just because it's a major, major challenge for them in their practice. Some people have maybe very little doubt. They can be very set, they're inspired, they're resolved, they kind of engage very deeply in practice until some major life crisis arises. And something really big happens in their life. They get some major illness, major financial crisis, major family difficulties. And then the doubt can arise. Oh, what good is this practice I'm doing? Now that I'm struggling with these major issues in my life, I can't see this practice. You know, what good is it going to do to sit down and meditate with all this? And then that's when a variety of different doubts can arise in times of crisis. Doubt has the effect of indecision, vacillation, holding back, sometimes resistance, sometimes giving up of things. The inability to decide, just don't know which way to go, left or right, don't know. It can also come often mixed with other attitudes, approaches, emotions. Sometimes it comes along with fear, sometimes it comes along with anger, sleepiness, boredom, discontent. It always comes along with a lack of mindfulness, with a lack of really quality presence, really attentiveness to what's happening here and now. That's part of the nature of mindfulness, is to keep you from being really attentive. One of the tricky things about all the hindrances, but especially with doubt, it has a kind of almost like a camouflaging quality to it, where the person can be in the grip of doubt, and we believe it enough, the doubt, that we don't see it as doubt. We don't see it as something that inherently doesn't know what's really best for ourselves. Sometimes it comes with it's interesting to see how doubt arises in relationship to other motivations we might have, or other feelings we might have. So, for example, there might be the feeling that someone might be really have a lot of desire, a lot of greed or something, and what they have or what they're getting, like in meditation practice, they may be feeling a little bit calm, a little bit centered, and, oh, but there must be something much better than that. This can't be good enough. This can't be enough. The grasses must be greener somewhere else. The meditation must be deeper somewhere else than this, than the carpet, not where I'm sitting. And there must be some deeper, something more here. This can't be good enough. And that kind of, this is not good enough, something else must be better, can lead some people to doubt because they're doubting this experience here. They're doubting the value of this. This is not important enough to be present for. I have to somehow get someplace else. There can be, doubt can arise from insecurity. Maybe a little bit similar to the first one, but insecurity that what I'm experiencing now isn't good enough. It's not, or I'm not experiencing the right thing. There must be a better thing to experience here. And not so much out of greed, but more out of fear. Oh, this is not good enough. I'm not kind of getting all that I'm supposed to get. And I better get it soon, otherwise I'll be a failure. The fear of failure can cause a lot of doubt. People practicing and feeling, well, my meditation is supposed to be at a certain level by now. I've been meditating for several months, and if I haven't reached the 30-second level yet of meditation, then it must be something, you know, I must be failing, and I better not admit it to anyone that I'm, you know, can't follow more than 2 breaths or 3 breaths. And so then, with that sense of fear of failure, then comes doubt about oneself, doubt about the practice, doubt about all kinds of things, because we feel like, you know, it's not going the way it's supposed to go, or not going fast enough. We're always measuring what's happening. One of the great movements of doubt, or the analogies of movement of doubt, you know, wondering where you are in practice, and is it good enough yet? Am I gone far enough yet? Analogy is a farmer going into her fields to check on the corn seedlings. Corn seedling has just come out of the ground, it's, you know, 1 inch high. And so you pull the corn out of the ground and look and see, you know, how deep is it, the roots. Well, you find out, you know, how well it's rooted, how well it was rooted. But you've now just destroyed the seed, destroyed the seedling. So sometimes doubt, you know, you're doubting what's going on, doubting it's good enough, doubting it's far enough. There's so much self-reflection that goes on, that self-doubting, self-concern, that we can't really get into the practice. We don't get rooted in ourselves in a deep way. There are people who have a lot of doubt because of the fear of the unknown. They have a lot of doubt about where they're going in their spiritual practice. They have a lot of doubt about what's going to open up for them, what's going to happen to them. If I sit here and I'm really present, what will I have to face? What demons do I have to meet? If I sit here and really let go in a very deep way, is that safe to let go? Is it safe to do that? There's a lot of issues around the fear of what might happen, the unknown, that can cause a lot of doubt, that people then struggle with it. So all these kinds of doubts can cause a person to kind of give up, or to stop, or hold back, resist. And a great teaching story that's sometimes told around this kind of doubt is a person who goes, a farmer who goes into the fields to dig a well. And so you take digging a shaft well. And after 5 or 6 feet, starts having doubt. There's probably not going to be water here. So, okay, well, over there must be. So they get up and they go over 30 feet away and they dig again, and digging down, and 5, 6 feet, and no water. Oh, it can't be here, mustn't be here, must be somewhere else. So they get up and go somewhere else, dig 5 or 6 feet, give up. Let's go up and somewhere else. Always somewhere else. This is not good enough. It's not going to be here. What they don't know is the groundwater is at 7 feet. And all they have to do is to persist and go a little bit further, and then they go farther. And this is true for a lot of people, that if there's too much doubt, people will doubt their practice, doubt their spirituality, when it gets kind of rough, when things are not going so well. Just like in therapy, they say that sometimes therapy really begins when you get angry with your therapist. Now, I'm not recommending it. Don't go home now and look for something to be angry with, but this, and not all therapists believe that particular theory, but because the theory goes along that sometimes when finally there's difficulty in the relationship, that's when you can start working things out. But what happens often, people will leave. People say, well, there's difficulty here, so now, you know, I'm not going to be hanging out there anymore. I'm not going to go do that anymore, that practice anymore. So that can happen with meditation practice. It can get rocky sometimes because the person you're having to relate to is so unreliable when you meditate. You know, yourself, right? And so, you're, in a sense, in meditation, you're also developing a profound relationship to yourself. And that's going to be as rocky as any committed relationship. And so you have to hang in there with yourself through all the difficulties and challenges that might come up, and learn about yourself and see it through to the other side. So doubt can interfere with that process of hanging in there. So there can be a doubt in a lot of things. One of the things that there can be doubt on is the teaching. So in Buddhism, the teachings of the Buddha, the teachings you hear. And certainly there can be doubt among some of the teachings that in Buddhism that might seem very strange to the uninitiated. The teachings on not self can cause a lot of doubt in people's minds. What? If there's no self, then who's practicing? Or if, you know, does it mean I have to get... If I do this practice, then I'm going to end up having no self? And then, you know, then I won't be able to pay my taxes. You know, or whatever. And so this is probably not a good practice for me. So there's a lot of doubt over the teaching. There can be doubt, you know, this whole idea of letting go. You know, if I let go, then what good is that going to do? If I just let go, let go, let go, then I won't have anything available to defend myself, to get ahead in the world, to kind of build up my life in a nice way. And so I'll just be a mess and things won't go so well for me. There can be doubt about spirituality in general, in that some people associate Buddhism with spirituality. The word spiritual is a big red flag for some people. What have I gotten myself involved in now? Gil used the S word one more time. And I don't know what he means. You know, it's such a vague word, and what am I getting involved in here? It must be a cult. And so there can be doubt that arises because of, you know. And probably it's a good idea to have some doubt when people use the word spiritual too many times. So some doubts are healthy. But then there's a difference between having some kind of healthy doubt, healthy skepticism of what you hear, versus translating that into a hesitation to be resolved, a reluctance to practice and test the practices being offered. There can also be doubt in... so this is an interesting thing. So if the doubt is in the practice, in the teachings of the Buddha, for example, that's that creates the context for Buddhist meditation practice, then you can always keep in mind the idea that the Buddha's teachings were always rational. So it might be a little bit hard to understand the rationality sometimes, but the Buddha did not offer teachings that were esoteric, that were mystical, you know, kind of intuit your way into it and feel your way, or, you know, he had a very rational approach. Maybe everything about Buddhist practice is rational in terms of how your heart opens and how your mind opens in a big way. But at least a basic core understanding and teaching that supports this practice is understandable. So if you have doubts about the teaching, that's what's kind of inhibiting you, then remember this idea, at least, that it's rational. So maybe there's some way you can kind of study it or have a conversation with someone about it or think about it and come to some kind of clarity about what the teachings are. And if you can't get to some clarity about it, then, of course, it makes some sense to have some doubt. So at least it's my suggestion to you is that Buddhist teachings, it's possible to find clarity there. And if someone is offering something that's not clear, perhaps they're using poetic language or using some kind of evocative language that has its own value in and of itself. But if it doesn't work for you, remember that then there's other avenues of understanding that can bring you a lot of clarity about what these teachings are about. So that can help lighten up the doubt. There can also be doubt in the practice. Someone might have a lot of understanding of the teachings. Teachings sound fine, but they have doubt about the value of the practice. When I was ordained as a Zen priest in 1982, my father came, and he was okay with me being ordained. And he said to me, he's kind of okay with it, but what he said to me, he said, well, you know, I've read a little bit about Buddhism, and it seems like a great philosophy and makes some sense, but I don't understand why anybody would practice it. because there's so many fun things to do in the world. And so, you know, why waste your time, you know, when you can sit down and close your eyes and you can go off and do these fun things? That's an interesting, you know, kind of doubting mind. I'm sure some of you have wondered that. What? Sit down and meditate? When I could be, and you can fill in, you know, the blank. When I could be watching television? So doubt in the practice. There can be doubt about, is this the right practice? Or doubt that you understand the practice. Or doubt, you know, mindfulness is so simple. Just pay attention. They keep saying, just pay attention, be present. But they don't understand. My life is really complex. My mind is really complex. I have these big issues. I have big emotional things. I've been a victim of a lot of different amazingly complex phenomena. And they tell me, just be present. These people don't know what they're talking about. And so there can be a doubt about, you know, the value of something as simple as presence, being really present in a quality way. A classic avenue for doubt is doubt in the teacher, and or the teachers, all the teachers, or particular teachers. And some of that can be good. There's definitely a lot of healthy doubt that can be there, questioning doubt. But questioning healthy doubt is not limiting. When doubt is healthy, it hopefully prompts you, encourages you to question further, look more deeply, look into it better. When doubt is unhealthy, when it's a hindrance, it kind of stops you in your tracks, kind of leaves you vacillating, unsure what to do, not engaged. It kind of helps you to disengage with what's happening. So it's very important to understand the difference between healthy doubt and unhealthy doubt, or doubt as a hindrance. So there can be doubt in the teacher, and sometimes that's well warranted, and sometimes it's not the teacher that we doubt, but rather the teacher has become a projection of all our frustration, or the fact that we're up against the wall, but we've come to some place in our practice that's difficult. And rather than face the difficulty in ourselves, sometimes it's better to kind of attack, blame someone, or find, you know, find fault in somebody else. You know, and one way of finding fault is to have doubt. It's safer. It's safer. Because if you kind of find fault, that person's a bad teacher. That's not so safe because it's kind of critical. But, oh, you know, I don't know about that teacher. I don't know if I can get so close to that teacher. And I think I'll hold my distance. I think I'll sit, you know, in the new garden out there. And you know, take a while, you know, see if this is a trustable place. And so there can be doubt in the teacher, doubt in oneself. That's probably one of the biggest doubts. Doubts if I have the capacity. Can I really do this? You know, this practice seems really, really difficult. It seems like it's asking something of me, and it's taking me to a place that seems so lofty. It seems impossible for me to engage in this. I don't know if I can sit still for 45 minutes. I don't know if I could really develop my mind well enough to stay focused on more than 10 breaths in a row. I don't know if I could really have the I feel so broken, so brokenhearted. I don't know if I can ever develop my loving kindness. I don't think I have that capacity. And sometimes when there's doubts like this, people might still try to practice meditation or loving kindness practice or anything, but the doubt becomes wind drag. They try, but the trying, not that it's half-hearted, but it's like the juice is not there. We kind of like take half a step forward and half a step back, you know, or just like we have one foot in and one foot out. And when there's that kind of one foot in, one foot out, kind of, you know, we can't really settle down. We stay agitated, caught up. In order for the practice to work, there has to be both feet in. There has to be kind of a wholehearted entering into the domain of practice, entering into here, being present with whatever the practice is, some wholehearted engagement. And doubt is one of the things that can prevent that from happening. So what to do about this doubt? One of the most important things is to recognize doubt as doubt. Even when it's healthy doubt, it's good to recognize it as healthy doubt, because recognizing it as that might give you some fuel to then investigate more deeply, to look more clearly. But if it's the hindrance of doubt, we want to learn to recognize it strongly enough so it doesn't stop us in our tracks, doesn't hinder us, so we don't believe it. One of the great problems with doubt is usually comes with beliefs, and so then we believe those beliefs. I knew one person who had doubt that she could do the practice while she was on a retreat, and she didn't realize that she had this, the hindrance of doubt had arisen to her until she found herself on the airplane flying home. And meaning she had left the retreat early, you know, called up and got a new ticket and left the retreat. And the airplane going home, what was I thinking? You know, she got so wrapped up in her doubt. And now she's a wonderful Vipassana teacher. So it has a happy story. So to recognize it as it, and once also if you really recognize it, then there's a very interesting movement that I've managed to do a couple of times. And that is, you doubt better. You don't just kind of try to overcome your doubt. You just do it better. Get into it. And you do that by doubting your doubt. Because the believing the doubt that is often adds to much of the problems or the limitation. So doubting your doubt. Then, if you can, if the doubt doesn't interfere, to really kind of engage yourself in the moment-to-moment mindfulness practice. Engage yourself in being present. Often doubt, when we're caught up in it, is a departure from the present moment. I can't do this, meaning I can't get where it's supposed to take me. And then we're not here for this experience. We're concerned about where it's supposed to take us. I'm not good enough. Good enough for what? Good enough just to be here? No, you know, it means usually good enough to some idea we have. And so doubt is often entangled with concepts, ideas, beliefs that are taking us out of the present moment. And so one way to overcome doubt is to pour yourself in and really be here in the present moment in a full way. Not so unlike people who have panic attacks. And one of the interventions for panic attacks is to ask a person to open their eyes and look around the room and see if they can find any dangers in the room. No, the back that wall is safe, and the window is safe, and it's kind of stabilizing. It puts someone who's panicking in the present moment. They realize that here and now there's no fear, nothing to fear, and they begin to kind of disentangling themselves from the ideas and the concepts of the fear, and being caught in the emotions of the fear, and maybe they'll kind of dissipate or settle. When doubt is really strong, doing the same thing, just really being in the present moment and disentangling yourself from that spinning mind that's making all these ideas and thoughts and beliefs can be helpful. Another thing to do with doubt is to investigate it. Healthy doubt, you might investigate the teachings or other things, but with doubt, it's helpful to investigate the doubt. It's another form of doubting the doubt. Okay, what is this doubt about? Is this doubt there because I'm afraid? I'm afraid of where this practice is taking me. Is this doubt here because the practice is not going the way I thought it should be going? I'm not as concentrated or as present as I thought I was supposed to be after 20 minutes. And so that's the disappointment is underlying that. Or there's expectation that was underlying it. And so we investigate and see what's underlying it. What are the beliefs? What are the feelings? What are the attachments that might be the field out of which the doubt arises? Doubt doesn't arise by itself, but it arises because these other conditions are there as well. So to investigate, look more carefully what's happening. One of the ways to investigate, if you can review what happened before is what happened just before you had the doubt. Because sometimes just before the doubt might be the clue to why the doubt is there. So, for example, there's fear just before the doubt, then the fear maybe is the prompt for the doubt. Disappointment, prompt for the doubt, you know, or something. Frustration, because the desire, our grand desire is not fulfilled, and so then that sense of frustration is the catalyst for the doubt. And if you find something that precedes the doubt like that, then it can be more useful to stay present and investigate that catalyst than it is the doubt itself. It can also be helpful in doing mindfulness of doubt is to have your awareness of the doubt be really, really, really big, spacious. Like, imagine that your mind is like the sky, like a vast sky. Maybe like imagine what it's like to be on a beautiful mountaintop or desert and on a beautiful moonless night, and you have this infinite seemingly space and stars all around you. So imagine that your mind, your awareness is really, really big like that. And it's in that great, great space, there's a room for there to be a little bit of doubt bouncing around. And some people find if they kind of open the awareness up like that, then the doubt doesn't stick anywhere. They're less likely to believe it. But if we ride the doubt really close, so concerned about it and believing it and engaging in it, then we're claustrophobic and it's much more of a bigger deal. But so we're going to back up, open the mind, open the awareness, allow it to be there. Don't engage it. Don't be for it or against it. But just keep opening the awareness up as big as it can be and just let it kind of float there. And, you know, doubt can just do what it does. Free of us. With all the hindrances, a very important aspect of mindfulness is to turn the attention around 180 degrees. So rather than focusing on what the hindrance is about, like what we're desiring, what we're trying to avoid or pushing away, we turn around and we actually feel the subjective experience that's of having that hindrance. So with doubt, we turn around, we stop focusing on what we have doubt about. Doesn't matter what it is, we just ignore, kind of turn the attention away from the thing we have doubt about, ourself, the teaching, the teacher, the whatever, and turn around and let the attention come really in here and feel what it's like to be in a human body that's experiencing doubt. So we're interested in the experience of doubt, not what doubt's about. Is it energized doubt? Is it draining doubt? Are we feeling drained by it? Are we feeling agitated by it? Are we feeling frustration? Are we feeling fear? Are we feeling resistance? Are we feeling disheartened? You know, are we feeling kind of bouncing around, going back and forth between different options? Is the thinking mind kind of hyped up? You feel the hyped feeling? And so it's really a tricky thing to do, or it's an art or it's kind of a craft to learn to temporarily not focus on the problem that the doubt is concerned with, but rather to feel what it's like to be a person who has that problem. So we turn away from the object of attention to the subject of who is experiencing it. That's very powerful because it can free us from incessantly following the thoughts, the objectifying thoughts, things that we want or concerned about. And we bring ourselves really close in home to ourselves, and we can feel here. What are we like here? What's happening here? And whenever you can come close in home to yourself and just feel what's here, that allows you to see more deeply what's here and allows what's here to start moving and resolving itself, dissolving itself, evolving itself in a way that whatever needs to be done. And one of the great things that I've discovered in this practice is how much things, feelings, emotions, attitudes, intentions, body sensations, tensions, all kinds of things, that if I can be really present for it and just allow it to be there, that it has a kind of almost like a innate kind of movement to release, to freedom, to letting go. There's an inherent wisdom in the system that moves things towards help if we can be fully present in a non-interfering way. And one of the things that I've come to trust through my practice, the profound trust, is in the wisdom of being really present and mindful for my experience. It seems like it's a really profound way of opening up the depths of life, the depths of my own furnace in my house, so that I can glow rather than looking outside and everywhere else for the warmth, but find it in here. And in that warmth, we find all these things that we sometimes are hoping to get from the external world, or have the external world bring to us. We find some of the best sources of love, for peace, for joy, for satisfaction, for inner sense of well-being. Many things that people are hoping to get from the things in the world, we can find from within. And then, it isn't that we become self-contained and just live in our own little furnace, but rather we can bring those beautiful qualities out into the world. And rather than being concerned about getting love, it's much more interesting to love. What would you rather have? To be loved or to love? And with time, with practice, as the practice deepens, I think you'll find naturally that it's much more interesting, much more satisfying to love than it is to be loved, even though being loved is fine. But if we think that's what it's all about, that's what we're trying to fill, the hole we're trying to fill for ourselves, then probably your furnace is not on high enough. And then one of the things that overcomes doubt, of course, is trust. And trust is learned, or confidence. And confidence is learned by seeing how the practice, how spiritual practice, or how Buddhist practice, or how mindfulness practice, how meditation practice, actually brings us benefit. And it's good to see it in small steps, not to have this big bang theory of enlightenment. Only then will I know it's good. But it's really great to begin seeing how satisfying and meaningful it is to have one moment of mindfulness, to have a few moments of it, to really be present for a few moments here and now, and to recognize how valuable that is as you're standing in line in the supermarket, to really find that it's a palpable sense of satisfaction to be fully present while you're standing there and being there, as opposed to letting your mind run along the way it usually runs along, doing what it does. How could that person in front of me buy so much candy? And they're not going fast enough. And the clerk's not going fast enough. I chose the wrong line. Should I go to the line over there or the line over there? And, you know, if I go over there, this one might look, it's almost finished. I don't know what to do here. And they're, you know, standing there. You know, you can do a lot of things you can do in line that's a waste of time. Or you can be present. And by the time it's your turn to be with the clerk, you're really present for him or her. So that's a talk on doubt, the hindrance of doubt. So over these last 6 weeks, I believe, or so, I've covered the five hindrances. And and what I'm wondering about doing next week is see if enough of you are game. I mean, someone has to volunteer, so. Well, I think it's very interesting that for different individuals, maybe personality types, or just kind of that's the way they're born, or who knows why, But different individuals find that different ones of the five hindrances predominate for them more than the others. Some people are much more the desire type. That's kind of like how their mind tends to operate. Some are much more the aversion type. And then, you know, that's like, you know, they can avert at a drop of a pin. You know, then some people, sloth and torpors, fatigue is really the, you know, main operating thing that seems to operate for them and get in the way of so much of their life. Some people, it's restlessness, anxiety. And some people, it's doubt that's really big. So what I was hoping is we could have five people who would self-identify themselves in those five categories. So like someone to volunteer to feel, someone who would volunteer who feels like they kind of represent doubt. Someone who can represent, because it's really common for them, and they know well, that's what they're struggling with mostly. Someone with desire, aversion, sloth and torpor, and restlessness and anxiety. And if we could have five people, we could have a very interesting panel. When we've done something like this before, people find it eye-opening. How different people's experience is from each other. Wow, I had no idea that, you know, that people could be that way. That's what they're thinking about and dealing in meditation. I just thought everyone was like me. And it's really something to see the five different ways in which kind of some people are. So is that something people are interested? How many are you interested to come and witness that? Witness it is one thing, right? But I wonder if we could find, five volunteers for the panel. So if we don't, then we'll do something else next week. But so let's come next week, and we'll see if we can find five volunteers. And if that doesn't work, then I will have to give a Dharma talk on Dharma talk on volunteering or something. So thank you for this evening, and might be interesting for you to see how often doubt occurs for you in the course of the next week. See how frequent it might be. So thank you.